Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. Almost 60 years ago, back in the summer of 1965, it seems extremely distant, perhaps the most anthemic of 1960s songs came out, My Generation by The Who. The Who, of course, were the iconic English rock band formed in 1964. And the most famous lyric from this My Generation song was about dying. People try to put us down just because we get around things. They do look awfully cold. I hope I die before I get old. Talking about my generation, it was all the idea of youth, fetishizing, celebrating youth. Some of the Who did indeed die before they got old. Keith Moon, of course, the famous, very badly behaved drummer, died in 1978. But the rest of them are still around, including Pete Townsend, who wrote the song. When he wrote the song, he said that rather than thinking about dying, he meant, when he wrote the lyrics old, he meant very rich. Hope I die before I got very rich. Pete Townsend certainly got very rich. And perhaps he was speaking for his generation. My guest today is another iconic figure from the 1960s, perhaps not quite as rich or as famous as Pete Townsend or The Who, but certainly amongst academics. Maybe we should call you Michael the Keith Moon of our generation. Michael Ignatieff is a very distinguished writer, historian, politician. He's talking to us from Vienna, where he lives, and he has a wonderful new essay out about, appropriately enough, My Generation, the history of my privileges, and he's writing as part of that same generation that Keith Moon and Pete Townsend were part of. Do you remember that song, Michael?
Oh, I sure do. Sure. They were and still are, I guess, a fantastic band. That's part of my growing up, no question about it.
Well, you've grown up. You've grown up from The Who to classical music in Vienna. And coming back to Townsend's remarks about he didn't really mean die, he meant get very rich. This is the essence of your essay, isn't it? The history of my privileges is that your generation, the generation that was born, I think, between 45 and 46 and 1960, they were a generation of rebellion, of celebrating going against the system, that not only have they survived, not only have they become very old, but they've become very rich.
Yeah, no question about it. It's a surprise to me. I mean, let me make clear what I mean by rich. I mean, it's kind of middle class rich. You know, I was professionally employed all my life. I haven't made a huge bunch of money, but I'm comfortable in ways that surprise me, and I will hand on to my children, I hope, something that allows them to live well. So the privilege is that we were rebelling against a system and then did very well out of a system. That's number one. And secondly, I don't think we realized at the time how lucky we were to have born at the beginning of what was 30 years of a post-war boom that lifted all our boats and got us going. So, and I think we see that now when we look at our children, who many of our kids are having a much tougher time. To be born in 1980, 1990, 2000 is a much different experience than to have been born as I was between 47 and 60. And that's what the essay tries to talk about. In a sense, the biggest privilege of all is simply having been born when I was born. And in this case, born in a prosperous Canada, you know, in a peaceful, stable country. These were cards that were dealt to me early, and I didn't realize how lucky I was to have been dealt them. And now, at this stage of my life, I look back and realize, wow, I was given some very good cards. I hope I didn't screw them up. You know,
if For a man of your intellectual sophistication, Michael, it's surprising to hear that. I mean, you were born into a, what you might think of if it's not a contradiction in terms, a Canadian aristocratic family. Your paternal grandfather was a Russian count. You were from very distinguished blood. Didn't you realize that when you were growing up?
Oh, sure. I felt a little special, but let's be clear what it was. I was, my grandfather was a count in old Russia before the revolution, but we lost everything in the revolution. So my narrative growing up was that I was the son of refugees who'd started again in Canada and were lucky enough to get to Canada and had a good life as a result. And then my father married in what could be called a kind of the middle class aristocracy of Canada. You know, they were professors, they were leaders, they were teachers. So I grew up in this kind of middle class aristocracy. There wasn't a lot of money, but there was a good deal of prestige being connected with these families. And I think I was, I mean, your question is, was I aware of that? Oh, sure I was. Sure I was. And I felt that was another of the privileges that were handed to me before I came on. And it's, I think I'm wrestling with a sense of, I've done my best to make something of my life, and I've crafted my life and achieved some things on my own. But I'm trying to enumerate the things that were just incredibly good luck, were privileges that were handed to me and that I did something with. I hope I didn't throw them away, but I can't take much credit for some of the things that happened to me because I had such a lucky start. And I think it's important to recognize that. And I'm trying, let me add, the key point here is I'm trying not to talk about myself. I think in some sense, I'm typical of an entire generation. And one of the things, and this is why it's called A History of My Privileges, is that it's only in the last 15, 20 years that we've begun to see these things as privileges, privileges that have to be explained, that have to be justified. We're supposed to feel guilty about. I don't feel guilty about having been dealt these cards. I would feel guilty if I threw the cards away, but I don't feel guilty about being dealt the cards because, you know, that's just the way it was. But I think this reckoning we're all having now with the fact that we were privileged is part of the interrogation that the next generation is directing towards us. And so it's a reckoning that's overdue. It's a reckoning that's necessary. And I, you know, that's why I wrote the piece.
You mentioned your daughter, your family. One of the points you make in and it's an excellent essay, by the way, as all your stuff is, Michael, but this is really particularly good. I hope you, as I said before we went live, I hope you'll turn this into a book. You compare yourself to your, well, implicitly at least, you compare yourself to your daughter. You mentioned that she's in London and she's had to apply for, what, 10, 15, 20 theater jobs in the last few years, whereas you never applied to anything. But surely, Michael, there were many failed Michael Ignatievs in the 50s and 60s, people who wanted to go to Oxford and write biographies of Isaiah Berlin and become ministers of parliament and get all sorts of fancy speaking gigs and become rector of the Central European University. Every generation has its successes and failures. And I'm sure we could find men or women of your daughter's generation who got the best gigs in theaters. Has anything really changed, or is there this sense of impending gloom or doom suggesting that everything's gone wrong when nothing much has really changed?
Yes, it's difficult. People are looking at the millennials, the generations coming after mine, and are noticing, in fact, that while they're complaining a lot, they're inheriting a hell of a lot from us, and they're getting a pretty good start. So there is
$4 trillion, according to you.
That's right. That's a New York Times statistic that I used, and it's a kind of staggering thought that this generation born between 1945 and 1960 is leaving $84 trillion to the next generation. And that's a hell of a lot more than the budgets of many countries. So it's a huge tidal wave of money that's breaking over my children and even grandchildren. And so that does create continuity, but it's not lived that way. My daughter says in the piece, because it's something she said to me, you left us our expectations. You left us your expectations, but not your opportunities. There's a gulf between expectation, my expectation that she would have a good, successful professional life, and the opportunities that have actually been available to her in a very, very tough commercial situation in the London theater. And I think that's a sensation that a lot of parents of my generation have about their kids. They just have a sense that it is actually tougher for their kids than it was for us. And so that's what I'm trying to capture in the piece.
What about the failures of your generation? You assume that everyone turns out as Michael Ignatieff, but there must have been many failures, bitter people, people who didn't make of themselves what they dreamt of. You're unusual in that sense. What happened to them?
Oh, look, and let's get real here. I've had a bunch of failures myself. I don't want to...
But there are failures that most of us would have liked, Michael, you know, failures in not being elected, or failures in not becoming, you know, not one book, not becoming a bestseller or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I will say in my defense that I tried, but I don't want to... I don't think of my life, I've been asked this often, I don't think of my life as a failure or a success. I just think I lived it. What I would say is that I lived it to the max, to the best of my ability, would be all I would think. But I think there's been a tremendous amount of failure. I mean, a lot of the failure is very personal. Marriages that break up, you know, just hopes that are dashed by the transformation of the economy. There's a lot of wreckage in my generation. A lot of people in their 70s and 80s looking at their lives and thinking, what the hell happened? What the hell happened to me? I started out so great, and here I am alone. I'm divorced three or four times. I haven't made anything of my life. And so, you know, at this period in my life, I think it's a reckoning for everybody. We're all sitting there looking back at our lives and trying to see the narrative that shaped it. And then we're looking forward to our children and wondering what kind of life they're going to have, and hoping that we can pass something on to them that will help them for the storms up ahead. And it does seem a stormy future. I mean, the piece talks quite a lot about climate change. I think there's some real reasons to be worried that, you know, can we get through the 21st century? I think there's some real reasons to worry. Can we get through the current collapse of whatever international order there was? These are the things that I worry about as I think about my kids. And I'm sure that there's some illusions here. The future has always been threatening, and throughout the 20th century, it's been more threatening than it is now. So we need context. We need not to set our hair on fire. But I think the dominant feeling I have as I look at my daughter's life and my son's life is just, I just hope they have I hope history spares them, because that's another theme of the piece, which is the extent to which, you know, my parents were in London during the Second World War. They went through the entire Blitz, the V2s, they lost friends. My mother fell in love with a man who died at concentration camp in Germany. They knew real horror, real fear, and real suffering. History grabbed both of my parents in their 20s and shook them hard. Now, you know, one of the privileges I had living between 47 and now is that history never grabbed me by the throat and shook me around.
Is that a class thing, Michael? A couple of weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C. I went to the Vietnam Memorial, a long wall full of thousands, yes, tens of thousands of dead Americans who fought in the 60s, your generation.
Yes, exactly. And those...
hasn't entirely, in terms of suffering and the storms, the vicissitudes, the tragedies of history, hasn't entirely passed this generation.
That's a very good example. The Maya Lin Memorial is very haunting, especially for my generation, because these are the people whom history did shake and toss aside, and and it's a terrible thing to die for in an unjust war, and many of them were courageous young men who died at 20. And I knew, in my generation, I was at Toronto during the 60s. The place, Toronto, was full of people fleeing the draft, and then courageous people who decided to go back to the States and serve, and some of them didn't get back. So that tragedy was definitely part of my generation. I'm talking about myself. I'm talking about someone from a place like Canada, which didn't have the draft, didn't have to go to war, all that kind of stuff. We were spared an enormous amount of being cuffed around by history. But later, in the 90s, when I did a lot of reporting from former Yugoslavia or from Rwanda or from places like Afghanistan, that was the dominant experience that I had, was I could come into these places, report, share their experience, but I always get on a plane, get the hell out. And they were left being shaken by history and discarded by history and cruelly manipulated by history. And so I watched that, but I was a spectator. I wasn't a victim in the sense of, of all the privileges, that may be the most important, was that I was a spectator of history rather than a victim of history. And I think that's a phenomenon, certainly for anybody who grew up in Western Europe after the Second World War, or who was lucky enough to grow up in safety in North America. But I'm quite aware, Andrew, that, your example of the Vietnam generation makes it clear that this is not true for everybody. There were some people who were very much history's victims.
I like how you put it, Michael, cuffed about by history. One man who was in some ways cuffed about by history and in some ways above being cuffed about was your, I don't know if you would call him a friend, a mentor, Isaiah Berlin. You've written the great biography of him. You knew the man very well. Perhaps the most distinguished liberal theorist of the 20th century. I don't think you mentioned, maybe I missed it in the piece, in the Liberties piece. You don't mention Berlin here, but his shadow or his ghost lays over this essay, doesn't it, Michael?
Oh yeah, there's no question. Isaiah was born before the First World War and died in 1997, and always said, that his thinking as a liberal was all about the horror of the 20th century for the experience of fascism, the experience of Stalin's terror. Rather like me, he lived that period of horror and dislocation and destruction of his people, Jewish people, but was spared, was immune. And he had a certain kind of, not guilt, but a certain awareness that he had been privileged, lucky, spared the worst that history could do. And I think that sense, his sense of being spared by history, is, I think, did influence my sense of being spared by history in a different context, in a different time. And I think also, I'm a liberal. I'm a small L liberal. And once upon a time when I was in politics, I was a big L liberal because I led a liberal party. And I think there, liberalism has always had a kind of hopeful story to the world, which is that we can make our own history, we can be masters of our own history, and our history can be a story of progress. And the story of the gradual emancipation of people from ignorance and chains and slavery, and that's the story that liberals live by. But it's a story that's in tremendous trouble because history is not, there is progress in history, but history with a capital H is not a story of progress. It's a story of often of suffering and horror and fear and desperation. And Berlin had a very vivid sense of that. And that is many ways why I find his liberalism so persuasive, so realistic, so true to the times we've lived.
Yeah, I was in Riga last year. I visited the building where he was born. His name's on the wall. And it's interesting, just thinking out loud here, it'd be interesting to compare The Life of Isaiah Berlin and of Eric Hobsbawm, both who experienced the catastrophe of the 20th century, but intellectually or ideologically, their responses were very different. You seem to, in your work, you seem to have taken Berlin in some ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, if this is unfair, Michael, but you've retreated into the self. Your last two books, The Ordinary Virtues, and then On Consolation, which I think you and I have talked about before, both live and on tape, is a wonderful book. Are they, in a sense, these books, your later Ignatieff, are they a reflection of a retreat, a disappointment from the action, the theater of politics?
I mean, just so the audience knows, I was in politics for 5.5 years, and it ended in defeat.
I don't mean just in politics itself, but in thinking politically, a retreat into the soul.
Yes. I don't think so. I'd push back. I've always believed, all my adult life and going back to earlier books like The Needs of Strangers, I've always believed that one of the things you have to understand about politics is there are some things that politics can fix and some things that politics can't fix, some things that politics can give you and some things politics never can. The most obvious example is love. You know, the most important thing in all human life is love. Politics can't give you love. You haven't a right to love. If you get very lucky in life, as I've been, you get to be loved by someone and love them in return. And that's just the center of all life. But politics can't give you that. Similarly, politics can't spare you from death and suffering. What it can do is create, hopefully, the metaphor I've always liked is politics about creating a kind of granite under the feet of all citizens so that they don't have to face hard times and difficulties alone, and so that they all have a chance to succeed and to achieve the hopes and dreams that they have for themselves. Politics can do that, and I don't think I've retreated from that hope at all. I want it more than ever, and I want it particularly because I see so much of what we did achieve since 1945 fraying at the edges. You know, recently, Andrew, my brother died about a year and a half ago, and he spent the last couple of years of his life in and out of hospitals in Toronto in Canada. And I was just really shocked by the condition of these public hospitals. I mean, that everybody was doing their best. The nurses were terrific, the doctors, but it was such a shambolic system, just barely functioning. And I had a sense of sadness that the hopes that the liberal state created in people, that we'd create these fantastic public institutions like a healthcare system that would provide dignified, efficient, state-of-the-art care for all citizens. It's just a core belief of mine. To see in practice how threadbare it is, how kind of bad it is at the limits was sobering. And it didn't make me want to walk away from politics. It makes me want to walk back in and we got to hold on to this. We've got to build it. We've got to sustain it for everybody, because otherwise society is just going to come apart. This is what keeps society from being a jungle, the sense that there are certain fates, certain experiences that we all must share together and live together and sustain together. And the sense that the welfare state that I grew up in is now fraying at the seams is a source of real concern. And I think people who have, you know, school-aged children have the same worry. You know, are these schools giving kids the start they need? And all of those are political questions. So having said, on the one hand, there's stuff that politics can't do, like love and saving you from death. There are other things that politics must do, and it's just more important than ever. And my sense is I'm now, you know, in the last decades of my life, I worry so much that framework of justice, that framework of welfare, that framework of we're in this together is fraying everywhere I look. And that keeps me in, that re-engages me with politics pretty passionately.
So stepping back from this, you mentioned your brother, and you also know in, I'm not sure if this is the same brother, that you and he have lived off some of the proceeds from your parents' real estate. Maybe that helped pay for his healthcare towards the end of his life.
Sure, it did.
The $84 trillion that you quoted the New York Times on, that your and my generation are passing on to our kids and our grandkids. Is that, Michael, for better or worse, is the reality of the future of a privatized state, and not a privatized state, a privatized world where the state is increasingly, again, for better or worse, I'm not celebrating this, irrelevant, because of that $84 trillion of it, most of it will end up in the pockets of our children and grandchildren, who will spend it on their privatized healthcare like your brother might have done, beneficiaries, lucky or otherwise, from the wealth of their parents or their grandparents. Mm-hmm. Is the future, for better or worse, Michael, a retreat from that state? I mean, you speak almost mm-hmm. nostalgically about the promise, mm-hmm. the hope of the welfare mm-hmm. state of the 60s and 70s. It's in retreat everywhere. The Canadian welfare state, I'm guessing, is in certainly better shape than welfare states in the UK, and there never even been a welfare state in the US.
Yeah. That's a possible future, that the $84 trillion just increasingly privatizes the world, and the public provision frays ever more. And my son and daughter will grow old in a privatized world where, unless they have a good, you know, private pension and some money set aside to look after them when they're aged, they will go to the wall. I mean, I do fear that. But I think one of the biggest surprises to me about the liberal welfare state that was created between 1945 and the 70s and 80s is that our expectation was that its success would make people more generous, less, you know, less allergic to taxes, that as these systems deliver for people, they'd be less reluctant to shed some of their income in taxes. And in fact, what appears to be happening it's not going that way at all. The wealthier we all get, then the more reluctant we are to put into the common pot to sustain the life for all of us, and the more selfish, the more privatized, the more we become. And that seems pathological. I mean, there's some counterexamples. The one that I cling to is in the United States is Obamacare. It appears to me Obamacare wasn't perfect, but it was a massive step forward, and it appears to be to have created its own constituency of support. It is not as popular as it was even in the first Trump campaign to promise to abolish Obamacare. So there's some counterexamples, in other words, where we create a good, decent, humane social program that helps to do what I'm saying, which is create granite under our feet. That seems to be creating legitimacy for itself, but there are some very disturbing phenomena in which it seems to be consuming its legitimacy. And one of the basic places where that's happening most, and you really see this in Europe, is that the welfare state has this perverse effect in a place like Denmark, which has a cradle to the grave, super generous welfare system. The unexpected correlative of that is ferocious resistance to migration. That is, we've created this world which is for us, and we do not want to share it with people trying to get across our borders. So there's a direct relationship a perverse one, between the generosity of social provision for citizens in Western Europe and their attitudes towards migration. They do not want to share it with, and I understand it. It's not, you know, it's not, there's not rocket science to understand why people do not want to dilute the benefits that they want to be reserved for citizens. But these are the kind of perverse and unexpected effects of the politics I believed in all my life that we're going to have to sort out, because I just don't see any way forward into the future that doesn't have good education, good health care, good roads and schools, good transport, good infrastructure for all citizens. I'm a public goods liberal, and when I see public goods fraying, I get worried, because it begins to pull our societies apart. And to get back to where you were saying, it makes us all think the only future we've got is private, and a future in which all of our choices become private choices is a society that has nothing to hold it together.
Did we get it wrong, or did you get it wrong, Michael? Many of our audience will be very familiar with your excellent book, Blood and Belonging. That's the first book of yours I read, written back in 1995, which is in some ways a warning about the dangers of nationalism. You haven't mentioned nationalism. We've talked about some of the consequences of our neoliberal age. Do you think that you, as a public goods intellectual, a public good intellectual, not just you, but your generation, intellectually, do you think that we got sidetracked by the dangers of nationalism?
No, I think we were right to see the dangers of nationalism. I'm unapologetic about having focused so much on nationalism in the 1990s, because, again, you know, societies have to have something that gives them a sense of a we. And in some sense, the neoliberalism that we were just talking about, the destruction of the public goods framework and the increasing resistance to, you know, making the investments to sustain the public goods framework, has produced a kind of populist authoritarian reflex, which you see in someone like Trump, who's walking around preaching a very raw, ferocious, angry American nationalism that says, let's take the country back from those liberal cosmopolitan elites. Let's take it back from, you know, the immigrants. Let's take it back from what it has become and restore. It's a reactionary restoration of an American identity that gave people a sense of a common project. I just think nationalism is, in a sense, nationalism is the revenge that we've inflicted on ourselves for having destroyed the public goods that used to hold us together. Now we're held together by a kind of rampant ideology of we make America great again. And I think that's producing an increasing amount of racism, an increasing amount of, you know, build the walls higher and higher and higher. America alone, a fortress, all this. This is authentic nationalist language. But it responds, the point is, you know, liberal cosmopolitans like me condescend to nationalism at our cost, because people need identities. They need to have common beliefs. They need to have a we. They need to have a sense of sharing in an enterprise bigger than themselves, an enterprise that moves through time and that they can bequeath to their children. That's what the strong side of nationalism is, this yearning to be part of something bigger than yourself. And it can be murderous. It can be negative. It can be terrible. I think the incarnation in Trump's ideology is positively dangerous. But, you know, you can't have a society without nationalism, without national belief, without people feeling tears well in their eyes when they hear a national anthem, or they, you know, see a, you know, one of the heroes of the country or stuff. That's another thing.
Have you ever cried at a Canadian hero, Michael?
Oh, sure, sure. I've had all kinds of, not Canadian, well, this gets a little arcane, but I get very moved when I read the speeches of Sir Wilfrid Laurier, a French-Canadian prime minister from turn of the century, who was a fantastic politician and had a vision of the country, which is particularly moving to me because it was expressed in French, you know, our second language. But it was a vision of the whole country being bound together, Catholics, Protestants, English speakers, French speaker in one common enterprise. And I still find it moving. And that's Canadian nationalism. And I make no apologies for it. And it would be another connection I would have with Isaiah. Isaiah Berlin was the liberal thinker who had most house room for nationalism because he understood this. You know, societies are not markets. They're not, you know, there is such a thing as a society, and it's held together by common allegiances and common beliefs. And when we tear that tissue apart, we get something terrible. So,
yeah, and Berlin, of course, some of his most abiding intellectual legacy is as a student of the Counter Enlightenment. Two final questions, Michael, because I know you need to go. You're a historian, so you're good at standing back and taking the larger view. This is a wonderful piece, as always with your work. You seem to be there before everyone else. Are you really saying that your generation has failed?
I don't think so. You know, what is my generation achieved politically? We protested against a wicked and unjust war in Vietnam. Part of our generation, the African-American part of it, and some very courageous whites got us civil rights. So that's two things of which I still feel a deep identification and feel pride. Third thing we did was that we began to address the question of climate change. We did something about it. We changed the conversation of politics by putting climate change at the center. And I think that was good. The most important thing, finally, is the revolution of inclusion. You know, Andrew, when I was 21 or 18, when I went to college for the first time in 1965, I didn't know a single person who was gay. It wasn't because there weren't plenty of gay men and women. None of them would avow their sexual identity. Flash forward to 2015, and I'm officiating at the wedding of two men who love each other, who happen both of them to have been my students. That change, that revolution of inclusion that involved gay men and women, it's involved the increasing inclusion of women into the political framework of our lives, the inclusion of all God's creatures, regardless of race, sex, whatever. This revolution of inclusion has been tumultuous. It's turned our politics upside down. It's led to a lot of things that we don't know how to handle. But boy, oh boy, that change seems to me to be enormously positive. So I've named a lot of things that seem to me really positive achievements of my generation, but all of them, that's the nature of historical change, all of them create problems. Climate change is not fixed. The revolution of inclusion is not complete. The people who still feel excluded and condescended to and not fully part of the political system are probably larger than the people who feel the inclusion revolution has worked. We are still risk being plunged into unjust wars in the future. Every problem you solve in history creates a new problem you have to solve, and these will be the challenges of the next generation. Did we fail? You always fail because you never achieve everything you wanted. But those four things that we did, I think, were incredibly important and made the world a much, much better place. So I don't feel, I just think we have to be lucid. We have to be clear. We have to not pat ourselves on the back. We have to realize that the legacy we're bequeathing to the next generation is problematic and difficult.
And final question, Michael, on this next generation, there seems to be two ways of thinking about our current situation. On the one hand, history is cyclical, that everything is repeated itself, lots of pieces. And I'm sure you've given some thought to this about how 2024 and the increasingly overt, angry, violent demonstrations against U.S. support for Israel and the Gaza war seems to be repeating 1968. So we're back in the 60s now, and today's young people demonstrating in universities aren't really ultimately that different from the kids of the 60s demonstrating against Vietnam. And on the other hand, the idea that we're charting new waters entirely, that the world of the 2020s and 2030s will be entirely different from anything we have experienced or anything that anyone has ever experienced. Which of those ways of thinking about history do you think that the next generation should adopt in terms of charting a sensible course?
I think we always think the future will be entirely different from what we've lived and experienced. I think the piece that we're talking about is struck, in fact, by the deep continuities that remain. The history is less discontinuous, less of a series of ruptures than we think. We're entranced by the sense that everything changes all the time. But in fact, I look back over, 77 years of life, and I'm struck by how much is continuously remains the way it is. Yes, I now have a, cell phone. Yes, we're talking on Zoom. The technologies are different. But many of our problems, many of our anguishes, many of the things that make us cry or make us whoop with joy haven't changed all that much. And I think that there is a mood of gloom at the moment about the future, which is understandable because people are being killed in Gaza. People are being butchered in Ukraine. There is a great deal of horror and a great deal of injustice. I think it's actually a very, very good thing that students are demonstrating, as we did on campus. I don't agree with everything they say, but I wouldn't have agreed with everything I said in 1968. And as long as that sense of injustice, that sense that something is wrong, is kindled in the next generation, that sense, even if you disagree with what they say and how they do it, that sense of injustice is, and the refusal to accept it, is the most powerful driver of change in the world and the most powerful driver of good things in this world. And so I hope the piece is seen as, let's keep faith with the next generation and let's keep faith with the future.
We need to remind everyone that Michael's brilliant new piece, The History of My Privileges, is part of Liberty's Spring 2024 issue, Volume 4, Number 3. Always well worth the read. Michael Ignatieff, always a pleasure. And we will talk again. Thank you so much.
Please. Nice to see you. Terrific.